WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. President Biden says Egypt's president has agreed to let up to 20 trucks carry humanitarian aid to Gaza. But Mr. Biden warns,
if Hamas confiscates it or doesn't let it get through, or just confiscates it, then it's going to end, because we're not going to be sending any humanitarian aid to Hamas if they're going to come be confiscated.
During his trip to Israel, President Biden said Israel was not behind a Gaza hospital blast that killed hundreds of people. It has sparked protests in the Middle East. CBS's MTS Taieb in East Jerusalem.
Speaking to CBS News, Fadl Naim, a doctor at Al-Ahli, says Israel's army sent a warning to evacuate the facility less than 48 hours before that explosion.
They called our medical director and they told him, we warned you yesterday with two rockets. Why are you still working in the hospital? Why didn't you evacuate the hospital?
Hundreds of people have been killed in the blast. There are so many dead, they're running out of body bags.
President Biden will deliver a primetime address on U.S. response to Israel and Ukraine tomorrow at 8 p.m. Eastern. In Washington, D.C. today, hundreds of Jewish activists in support of the Palestinians gathered in the rotunda of the Cannon House building to demand a ceasefire in Gaza. One of the protesters interrupted the confirmation hearing for Jacob Lew to become ambassador to Israel, and at least 300 were arrested. Republican Jim Jordan loses during a second round of voting to choose a new House Speaker and is asked,
staying in the race and you feel like you're in good shape?
Yeah.
Another vote is scheduled for tomorrow. The mother of Alabama teenager Natalie Holloway says her killer has finally confessed, the latest from CBS's Matt Piper.
Natalie Holloway's mother, Beth, says Yaron Vandersloat confessed to authorities that he killed Natalie while she was on a high school graduation trip in 2005.
As far as I'm concerned, it's over.
Beth Holloway says his confession was verified with a polygraph test.
He finally confessed that he killed Natalie. He described when and how he killed her. He said that after killing her on the beach in Aruba, he put her into the water, and that was the last that he ever saw her.
Even so, Vandersloat cannot be tried here for her murder, but her family still calls it justice. Matt Piper, CBS News.
Police make an arrest in a multi-car crash that killed four women in Malibu, California. Investigators say the victims were walking along Pacific Coast Highway when it happened last night. L.A. County Fire Captain Sheila Keller-Burko was at the scene.
This one's tough. There's a lot of carnage, just metal carnage. And you know, anytime you come and there's four bodies that didn't survive, that's a tough one to watch.
This is CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed, because Indeed's all-in-one hiring solution helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit. Oh, oh, oh.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
The Wisconsin Department of Health Services has received nearly $17 million in federal funding to enhance operations of the 988 Wisconsin Lifeline. The service answers calls, texts, and chats to the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline program. The additional funding will build the 988 Wisconsin Lifeline workforce, strengthen connections between the service, 911 centers, and county programs, and raise awareness of the service through statewide advertising and outreach efforts. There's a new state record for the largest pumpkin ever grown in the state of Wisconsin. This past weekend, Brian Mathewitz unveiled the pumpkin he grew in Eau Claire, weighing in at a whopping 2,420 pounds. The oversized fruit is now the heaviest recorded pumpkin in Wisconsin state history. Mathewitz told WQOW that even he was surprised by the weight of the pumpkin, saying he initially thought he misread the scale and that it was 400 pounds lighter. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
People across Wisconsin are enjoying the rewards, stability, and flexibility of a career in healthcare. Why not you? WIS Caregiver Careers can get you started as a certified direct care professional. You'll learn the skills you need to make life better for older adults or people with a disability. All training is free and online, plus earn $500 in bonuses. Start your new career. Sign up today at WISCaregiverCDCP.com. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
Have you noticed bad behavior has become normalized at interscholastic athletic events? Some fans seem angry. They lack civility toward one another. Some even get aggressive and unruly. Time out! What is going on? This has to stop. Let's not forget, school sports aren't just about winning. And they're definitely not an excuse to take your frustrations out on the official or the opponent. They're about teaching lessons like perseverance, respect, and empathy, so students can learn and grow as people, not just as players. We all have a role to play in setting a good example for our students and teaching them these important values. So fans, it's time to step up your game and behave positively at Interscholastic Athletic Events in Wisconsin.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
93.5, The Tap. 93.5, The Tap.
Early.
Huh. And I thought China wasn't doing anything about climate change. I'm starting to feel like we've been lied to. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. I know. Lots of Jim Jordan stuff, lots of dysfunctional Republicans, lots. And you're hearing that everywhere, and we're going to talk about it as well. But you know, there's some other stuff going on in the world. Like yesterday, 3,700 casino workers in Detroit, they went to the picket line, went on strike at noon on Wednesday saying, hey, better wages, hours, conditions, something really important to us. So the dealers, the cleaning staff, the food and beverage folks said, what? We're withholding our labor. Did you see that in the mainstream corporate-controlled media? No, not so much. Also, Wednesday, big news coming out of California. Governor Newsom finally signing a pro-worker bill. Signed a pay raise for healthcare workers. Hundreds of thousands of California healthcare workers set the course for a minimum wage of $25 an hour for medical techs, nursing assistants, your custodians, you know, the people that we don't necessarily see or think of all that often in the hospital. But, you know, wouldn't it be nice, I don't know, for them to, I don't know, make a living wage? Now, here's the thing. This is where I said the other day, strikes work. Strikes work. Because when the Kaiser Permanente workers went on strike, the 85,000 of them, one of the things that they were able to negotiate in the new contract was a $25 an hour minimum wage in their contract for the workers in covered under that contract. $25 an hour minimum for California. I think it was 23 for all of the other states that they're in. So strikes work. And look, you know, this didn't just appear out of the blue either. This is a lot of work from working people coming together and saying, we demand better. Newsom didn't just wake up and go, oh, gee, wouldn't it be great if healthcare workers made a reasonable wage? Wouldn't that be fabulous? Not what happened. So what you're going to see is over the next couple of years, that minimum wage will tick up. $23 an hour in 2024, 24 and 25, and then 25 and 26. That's how that's going to work for most of. And look, here's the thing. If you pay people better, you will attract better people to healthcare. And then you'll get people who want to stay.
This is the thing. You're going to get people into your healthcare system who are going to want to be there, who are going to be able to think about being there, want to be there, afford to be there, and then you're going to think about people who are taking care of people in need. Kind of something we should be thinking about. And, you know, I'm looking at all of this stuff, and there are tons of these stories that our corporate-controlled mainstream media doesn't bother even looking at. If we organized our politics, and I've been saying this from the beginning, I've been saying this for years now, if you want to reunite this country, we've got to reunionize. We've got to get workers energized. We've got to get workers coming back together. Because if we organized our politics like these workers have been organizing and they're coming together in the workplace, we might actually, and we might actually have a functioning house. We might actually get things that workers need. I know it's a stretch. It's something we are not accustomed to, but it's possible. And look, just a couple of days ago, I had a listener send me this. I'm not sure where he got it. But I did look it up, and it's accurate. Sent me this this comparison between 2009 and 2022, where the wealthiest American was worth about $40 billion. Average income for people in this country was a little over $54,000. Minimum wage was $7.25 an hour. Fast forward 13 years, get you to 2022. Our wealthiest person, our Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, worth $265 billion. Average income for people like you and me, just over $53,000. So we went backwards. And that minimum wage, that pesky minimum wage, still 7.25. Still had not gone up. And as this person said, when you have laws that are written by millionaires, funded by billionaires, are you surprised that they benefit and we don't? And the answer is no, not surprising at all. Something that I've been saying for a very long time. Would be great to have working class people get elected into, you know, our houses of representatives, our senates, our governor's mansions, you know, people who know what it's like to miss a meal, miss a paycheck, not be able to pay their bills at the end of the month and struggle and worry. Might be nice to have someone thinking about, oh, the little guy. Which is why I love what's going on in Michigan. They elected working class Democrats, and they've been doing incredible work in Michigan for working people. They repealed the state's horrible, terrible no rights at work bill. That again, I go back to when Republicans rammed this through like thieves in the night, the wet dream of the Republican Party, right to work. Democrats took that back. They brought back prevailing wage, expanded the earned income tax credit. They even restored tax exemptions for pensioners, for people who are on a fixed income. They are listening to working people. And now, I love this too. Now they've got this piece of legislation they're moving forward on, the Call Center Job Retention Act. Now you may remember the Call Center Jobs Retention Act, because there was a certain senator from Pennsylvania, Bob Casey, who had a similar piece of legislation called the United States Call Center Worker and Consumer Protection Act that would have protected jobs from being shipped overseas. Because look, corporate America's, you know, they're making tons of money, raking in record profits, and they're closing these call centers, closing down jobs in Michigan, throwing people back onto unemployment, causing chaos, but lining their pockets. And Michigan's going, hey, maybe not. Maybe we're going to take some action. Now, here's the thing. Had we a functional government back in 2019 when Senator Casey and the co-sponsors, Sherrod Brown, Blumenthal of Connecticut, Cortez Masto of Nevada, Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin, Rosen from Nevada, even freaking Joe Manchin, Stabenow, Van Hollen, Durbin, and Peters, they signed on to the U.S. Call Center Worker and Consumer Protection Act. Had we done that then, wouldn't need it now. But didn't and haven't. Now it's up to Michigan to actually do something. And the thing is, we should be moving on this. We should be working hard to make sure that this happens so that we're actually protecting working people. But here's the part that bothers me. And this is the frustrating part. And I'm sure you saw this on Monday. Everyone was flipped out. I was just beyond myself when I saw this. You have Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, who is asked, you know, can we afford, you know, both wars? Can we afford war in Ukraine and one in Israel? Can we afford this? She was asked this on Sky News, and she said, "Oh yeah, you know, Americans can certainly afford to stand with Israel and to support Israel's military needs, and we also can and must support Ukraine in its struggle against Russia. The American economy is doing extremely well." Well, here's the thing: if we can afford to fight wars, we can afford to support working people. And I know there are people, well, we shouldn't be supporting these wars. No, we should be supporting these. We should be supporting the Ukrainians. We should be supporting what's going on in Israel. We should be supporting that with our money. Not our children, but give them the resources that they need to protect themselves. Absolutely, without question. They're fighting their war, so we don't. And that's where we should be on this. But here's the thing. When they say that we've got all this money for all these other things, what about working people? What about average, everyday working folks? And look, you're seeing some excitement. You're seeing some militancy. You're seeing some activity. But it's going to be more. And I look at the fact that our friends in the Culinary Union out in Las Vegas, they just came out with a report, The Human Cost of High Hotel Profits, a survey of Las Vegas guest room attendants. And what'd they find? What you know they're going to find. 99% of the people surveyed said the checkout rooms take longer to clean. 95% of them said the employer didn't provide a reduction in their daily work quota due to excessive travel between floors and towers and pushing the heavy carts. 88% said, hey, I'm in pain and discomfort all the time when I'm working. 77% said they've been directly asked by guests to clean their room, but had to decline because, hey, they've been assigned somewhere else. 67% said they don't have the adequate tools to do their job, cleaning supplies, equipment, and the such. 57% have had to see a doctor for work-related pain or injuries. And 43% have said they've missed family time and you know, events due to mandatory overtime. Again, you have to ask yourself, is work your life or is work how you pay for your life? You know, as an old timer told me, do you live to work or do you work to live? And we're in this moment where the billionaire class, the folks who want to get working people back into line, think you should be living simply to work and make them profits. Out of the fear of, hey, we're gonna automate you out of jobs, so you better not ask for too much, you better not demand much, and you better come and be happy. Well, I'll tell you, it's about time working people stand up. And I know all the distractions and all of the other news, it's important too. But this is kind of important in my view. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Got lots to get to, lots to talk about. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the speaker debacle, yeah, the craziness there, and I got to talk about that a little bit. We got to get to that. Fortunately, no Jim Jordan yet, and I don't think it's going to happen. In fact, John Boehner got a vote. Pennsylvania Congressman Mike Kelly cast a vote for John Boehner, and the clown show went wild. And I know Donald Trump predicted that Jordan was going to be the speaker the other day. Didn't happen. In fact, round one got Jordan 200 votes. Second round got him 199, so going backwards. Hakeem Jeffries still the same, 212. I'm of the mindset majority should win. You throw out the vote, whoever gets the most votes should win. That's just a thought. But let's go to the phones. We got Steve in Chicago on line one. Steve, how are you?
Fine, thank you. And I would tend to agree with you. The person who gets the most votes should win. But if that were the case, we all know that we would not have this issue because the Republicans would never have taken that risk by removing their last speaker. Because they knew that any future vote would mean that a Democrat would likely win. So, yeah, the system is what it is. Unfortunately, you know, for Republicans, you don't take the first jump without knowing what you're going to do second and third way out from that first jump. And they decided to take the first jump. They unseated their own speaker, you know, a man who had taken 15 ballots to get into the office. And now, of course, they didn't have any plan for how to get anybody new in there. You know, Scalise, as bad as he was, you know, it was at least a reasonably sane human being. I think he's still a despicable human being with regard to public policy, but he's not insane, unlike Jim Jordan. I mean, Jim Jordan, basically, for someone who's been in the House as long as he has, to have accomplished next to nothing, which is what he had done during his career. I mean, this is most people after that many terms in office, you can say that, you know, you've attached your name to these bills. You've sponsored this legislation. It got passed. No, Jim Jordan has cultivated a reputation of just destroying everything he gets near, poisoning it all. He's always in opposition to whatever Democrat bill comes forward. And then, of course, he's torpedoed his own people's bills in the past because they were rhinos. They weren't his brand of Republican. So, this is the guy that they want. As Speaker, no, because there are, again, a few sane Republicans, and they know full well that, okay, hypothetically, Jim Jordan becomes the Speaker of the House. Well, that means that Jim Jordan is the Speaker of the House when we decide to certify the 2024 election. Now, could you think of a worse scenario, given that this guy is supposed to be involved intimately with the planning of what happened on January 6th?
Yeah,
so I think that there are a few sane people in the Republican Party who are saying, okay, look, we're not saying we make a Democrat the speaker, but this guy, we could be looking at civil war a little over a year from now if this idiot is elected. So, as you said, we can address what's going on in the rest of the world and talk about this. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. We have that capacity. We're a modern society, and we have enough scholars and researchers and experts so that, you know, you can tune into one story, and then you can tune into the other one. That's what happened all day today. We were talking about what was happening in D.C., and we were talking about what was happening in the Middle East. And, we've been here before. You know, we were fighting the Vietnam War while Watergate was going on. So, yeah, we can do these things. It doesn't require, you know, some sort of magical recipe that hasn't existed before.
Do you see this, Steve, as the possibility of maybe, to use the fever breaking on MAGA, because Jim Jordan is Trump's handpicked guy? Do you see this as the beginnings of potentially, you know, some Republicans pushing back against Trumpism?
Oh, I believe so. I mean, I think I've seen a bit of a shift. It's not as much as I had hoped, but you're starting to see people speak up and say, no, this is a bridge too far. And, you know, and in the past couple of years, okay, despite Donald Trump being defeated soundly in 2020, you still had the Republican Party sort of putting their finger up in the wind and saying, okay, which way is it blowing? Okay, I need to be silent, or I need to tacitly endorse MAGA, because, you know, they're the largest power block within our party. You know, pretty much that they're the ones who rule right now going forward. And if you don't want to be primary from somebody on the right, yeah, you need to pay lip service to them, or at the very least, don't open your mouth, because, you know, those who did, the Mitt Romneys, the Adam Kinzigers, the Liz Cheneys, we all know what happened with them. But now I think that there are some who are starting to say that, yes, you know, that this is nuts. These people are not going anywhere for us as a party. We can perhaps win some seats in some hard MAGA districts, but what does that do for us in terms of national elections? I mean, you know, what happened in 2018? What happened in 2020? What happened in 2022? Okay, how many of these election cycles need to take place before we get the idea that MAGA is not the way to go? It's a regional party in many ways in the South and parts of the West, but nationally, no, this is not what Americans want. And now, you know, they couldn't have served up anything better for Democrats than this chaos. If somehow McCarthy were to become a speaker again, or if, say, his underling, who is now Speaker Pro Tem, so McHenry becomes speaker and he has some sort of powers that are sort of vague right now. We can't actually define it. There would have to be some sort of a meeting, a sit down in which we define exactly what powers he's going to have. And then he has those powers until the next election, and then another speaker can be elected. But beyond that, what does that do then? It just says to American voters, the Republican Party that you're looking at today can't govern its own house.
Yep.
That basically, you had McCarthy, you either voted out and then voted back in, which would send one heck of a message, you know, or to his underling now has some power, not all the power of the Speaker of the House. The Republican Party has the majority, but they don't have the full power of the speakership. And so what does that then say about their party? And so, you know, it's a great place to be for Democrats politically, but it's a dangerous place for us to be as a country.
Absolutely.
Because not having a speaker, a functional speaker, and not like tomorrow, if we had a crisis tomorrow, and we have enough of the minor crises now, but if we had a major crisis tomorrow, we could not move legislation forward. If this were 9/12 instead of today, what could we pass if we were in this sort of environment? So, yeah, I mean, great situation for Democrats, but I'm one of those people who likes to put country ahead of party, and I do think we need a functional government.
There you go. Good stuff, Steve. Appreciate the time, man.
Thank you.
Let's go to Alice on line two. Alice, how are you this fine day? Did I lose you, Alice?
Oh, I'm here. The phone's acting up.
Okay. What's on your mind?
Okay. Well, a couple of things. Number one, the Republican Party is just showing how totally disorganized and insane they are. And I think some of their donors might be getting a little bit upset because, you know, we have this big war machine going on. And how are you going to, get them more profit if you cannot get the government to go, okay, we need to, you know, send the money here, send aid there, do this. And the second thing I wanted to say is, well, you know, some of these companies and the millionaires and billionaires better think about this. Our economy is a consumer economy. And if people don't have money to spend because they're not making anything, then profitability is going to go down. But you have a good evening, Rick.
Thanks, Alice. Appreciate the thoughts. This is one of those moments where no function in the House. The party of no thoughts, no ideas, no vision, no direction, and no speaker. This is what they get you. Now, Jim Jordan's a guy who, and I've been banging this around for a while. This is a guy who's a bully, but has nothing to bully with. This is what happens when, because someone asked me, well, you know, how does, you know, what happens when bullying backfires? And I'm going, Yeah, they're evidently they're making threats to a lot of people. In fact, Representative Marianne Etta Miller Meeks, a Republican from Iowa, said that she's gotten credible death threats, a barrage of threatening calls. You know, people are going after her in a big way, and she said, I'm not caving in on this. Because there's nothing for Jordan to threaten her with. Sure, you're going to get the MAGA people who are going to be mean and angry and say stuff. But when you've got nothing to bully with, and look, you think about the Tom DeLays of the past, the Newt Gingriches, they just said, well, we're just not going to give you money. Jordan isn't the money man. He doesn't have the power of respect of the colleagues. He doesn't even have the Trump support. Because I don't even know that Trump's willing to go to the mat and help bully for him. Really hasn't. So going to be interesting to see how the next couple of days go on. I want a speaker. It just can't be someone like Jim Jordan. Bad idea all the way around. Do want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1933. That was the day garment factory owners locked out dressmakers in several shops throughout Los Angeles. The women garment workers, overwhelmingly Mexican, had been organizing with the ILGWU for over a month. They began conducting strikes at selected shops the previous month to press their demands. The women wanted union recognition, a 35-hour work week, end to homework, shop floor committees, a guaranteed wage, and more. Historian Douglas Monroy observed that their demands reflected the harsh working conditions that they faced. It was a volatile, competitive seasonal industry. Businesses worked tirelessly to undercut each other and job out the work. Women workers were routinely unemployed or underemployed, subject to widespread wage theft and discrimination. They were frustrated by promises of the new Industrial Recovery Act, which promised the right to organize, but held no provisions for enforcement. Employers flaunted the new legislation and continued to discharge workers for union activity. When the employers forced a lockout, Local 96 looked to the AFL's Central Labor Council to sanction a general dressmakers' strike, which started 4 days later on October 12th. As many as 3,000 Latina strikers maintained solid picket lines despite dozens of arrests. ILGWU organizer Rose Posada arrived from New York to help with food distribution and packing the picket lines. The rank-and-file leadership produced a bilingual strike bulletin and made daily radio announcements. The strike ended in arbitration that conceded few gains to the garment workers. But the women of Local 96 continued to organize throughout the Los Angeles area. They led a series of strikes that would eventually win the closed shop.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show.
If the Democratic Party wants a big hot issue that would force the GOP to admit its disdain for democracy, how about those Supremes? The Supreme Court, intended to be an apolitical, neutral arbiter of legal cases brought before it, has been elevated to a supreme legislative body by the 6-person majority of extreme right-wing partisans now controlling our third branch of government. I'm hardly a legal scholar, unless you count my week and a half in law school, but you don't have to be in who's who to know what's what. From my lifetime in politics, I can attest that what these Republican judges are doing is pure politics, using their black robes as cover for flagrant political activism. Coordinating surreptitiously with right-wing ideologues and corporate money powers that shower favors on them, they intentionally bring up case after case designed to rewrite America's laws. These 6 aloof judges are effectively enacting a new political order of plutocratic, autocratic, and theocratic power over the beliefs and democratic will of America's pluralistic majority. Posing as conservative jurists, they've steadily concentrated arbitrary lawmaking power in their own hands. Reaching way beyond the court's constitutional role of deciding cases, today's Supremes now effectively create law by choosing cases to bring up, favoring those fabricated by such right-wing political allies as the Koch brothers and the Federalist Society. Moreover, the 6 partisans even rule on legal questions the case doesn't raise, simply making up and answering their own question.
This is Jim Hightower saying, with no legal, ethical, or electoral checks on this secretive, anti-democratic government, the court now routinely rules against workers, women, civil rights, the environment, personal liberties, and, well, against America. Shouldn't we have at least one political party calling them out and reining in their arrogance?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it's been fun and entertaining watching Donald Trump dance around this gag order. In fact, yeah, what was it? He released Letitia James's home address. At some point you got to go, gonna have to hold somebody accountable. Because any other defendant, if it were you, if it were me, anybody else, we'd be sitting in jail for any of these antics. Now, he said he's willing to go to jail if that's what it takes. And if I'm one of the judges, I got to tell you, I think at some point, someone's got to pull the trigger on that one and throw his give him an orange jumpsuit to match the hair. But here to share some thoughts on, you know, is this normal? Is it normal to put this kind of a gag order on someone? Is it normal to restrict someone's free speech, as my right-wing friends keep telling me? That's why I've asked a former federal prosecutor and host of It's Complicated podcast to come talk with us. Renato, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely. Happy to be here, Rick.
So let me ask you this. I mean, you know, is this normal? Is it normal for a judge to go, hey, you can't say this. You can't speak in public. You can't talk. In your years of being a prosecutor, have you seen this?
No, because usually the defendant is totally screwed. And they realize that pissing off the judge is basically the last thing on earth they'd want to do. Because that judge is going to be making the rulings at trial. And that judge is going to set the sentence. So typically, defendants do not thumb their nose at the judge and defy her orders.
And don't give out the prosecutor's home address.
Yeah, the prosecutor usually wields a lot of power over you, too. So they're going to be the ones making the sentencing recommendation if you get convicted. So typically there's a level of collegiality and politeness that exists that doesn't always exist in regular civil lawsuits because the defense always knows that they ultimately may need something from the prosecutor. But obviously, that's not the Donald Trump playbook.
Well, I got to think that he knows he's screwed, you know, legally. So what he's got, the cards that he's playing is you got to taint the jury pool. Because I keep saying, I think what's going to happen, you know, again, I don't have a crystal ball. I'm not clairvoyant. But there's part of me that goes, I've seen enough bad movies to know it only takes one juror to throw a wrench into our whole system. And I fear that could possibly happen.
Yeah, it's like a runaway juror. Wasn't there a John Grisham novel about that?
There's a bunch of 13 Angry Men. There's been a bunch of movies over the years where, and look, that's the beauty of our system. If someone is truly not guilty, that, you know, what's the saying? 1,000 guilty people go free so that one innocent man doesn't go to jail. Well, he doesn't appear to me to be that one innocent man.
Does not appear to be. I agree with that. I do think that a lot of these antics, I think, have limited value. I'm not sure how many D.C. voters and thus jurors are going to be tuning into his antics. But I do think it puts the judge in a difficult situation. So we've actually had a couple gag orders recently, two different ones. So one that was an easy call for the judge, which was this was in that New York case. Donald Trump tweeted out or truthed out or whatever he calls it, a photo of the judge's law clerk and with Chuck Schumer and suggested that she was somehow involved with Chuck Schumer, made some lies up about her. That was an easy call for the judge because she's a court personnel. She's not a public figure. This is not an issue of public concern. It is in fact false. And it's really an attack on the judiciary. So that one was an easy call for the judge. And I think Donald Trump complied by taking that truth social post down like right away.
Yeah, but
I'm
not
surprised by that.
Once you put it up, it's like anything, and you know this as well as anyone. Once you put it up, it never goes away.
It's like they call it the Streisand effect. I don't know if you're right, where it's like, I think, didn't she want some photo down and then it just made it more popular, something along those lines?
Exactly.
Yeah. I agree with that. But it would definitely, that one for the judge was an easy call. Now, we had more and more recently with Tanya Chutkan in D.C. So she's the judge presiding over the federal January 6th case that was brought by Jack Smith. In that case, you know, she had threatened earlier that what she was going to do is move up the trial date. I think that would have been a much better move by her, because judges typically have complete and unfettered control over their schedule, their trial calendar. But what she ended up doing is trying to limit his speech. That's actually challenging to do. Gag orders don't happen often for good reason. And when it's a presidential candidate talking about public figures during an election, you know, Rick Smith is, you're maybe not, I don't know if you are a public figure or not, but Jack Smith is. And I think, you know, that'll be an interesting one on appeal, but I think she felt like she needed to send him a message.
Yeah, but here's the thing, and I'm not comfortable with you know, gagging, any gag orders or anything like this, just because I know Trump is going to violate it on purpose so that he can then again look like the victim and look like the guy who's, or we're fighting the fight. I don't want him to come out of this looking like the martyr. This just seems like one more of those things that's being piled on.
Yeah, if I was this judge's law clerk, I would have advised her not to issue the gag order. I mean, so from a First Amendment perspective, it's very problematic when any part of government, including the judiciary, tries to restrain somebody from speaking before they speak about something, okay? Saying, hey, you cannot talk about this subject or that subject. Very, very closely scrutinized. And here, he's running for president, and a lot of the witnesses are public figures, General Milley and, you know, so on. The prosecutor is basically a public figure, right? People are making podcasts and, yeah, TV shows about that guy. I mean, he's kind of a big deal. So if you and I can talk about Jack Smith, you know, it's very hard to limit that. So I wouldn't have gone there. I just, like I said, I would have just told the guy, hey, tell you what, you're creating a lot of problems for me. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to move up the trial date a couple of months so I can get you off my calendar. And well, that's what I would do.
That's actually a really great idea. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show with Renato Mariotti, former federal prosecutor and host of the It's Complicated podcast. You can find that wherever you find your favorite podcasts. We'll get links out on social media. Now, me, I would have gone the complete opposite way. I would have said, hey, dummy, keep talking. You know, keep putting stuff out. Keep giving us exhibit A, B, C, D. Talk until, here's a shovel. Keep digging.
Yeah, I think ignoring him is generally one of the best ways of handling any loudmouth or bully. And in his case, in particular, attention is what he's looking for. And so if you don't give him attention, I mean, I don't know if you noticed. I mean, he's a lot less relevant nowadays. He's on that ghetto version of X, Twitter, whatever, where, you know, he's in truth land. So, you know, the irony's not dead, right? It's like the Pravda of social medias. So he's there. No one really pays attention to his speeches and public statements anymore, unless you're watching Newsmax. And he's just sort of off doing his thing. So I think, you know, I would just let that happen if I, you know, but, you know, the judge is doing what she's going to do. I personally think part of what's going on is the prosecutor is rightfully, by the way, goading her on. In other words, prosecutor is a different role. He's not a judge. He's there to just try to throw tomatoes at the defendant and try to get a conviction, right? And so he's just, every time Trump misbehaves, the prosecutor's putting it in front of the judge. I think the judge needs to draw some hard lines here. So a lot of people were applauding this gag order. I'm not so sure about it.
No, I wasn't one of them. I'm uncomfortable with any of that stuff. I was uncomfortable throwing him off of social media platforms. I know what, you know, what a whole bunch of people were, you know, no, we've got to get rid of him. No, I want him saying dumb stuff. Give me exhibit A, B, C, and D. Now, I did find it interesting that he, again, you know, he has the most expensive house probably in the world, which is Mar-a-Lago, he said during his his rant at the civil trial, where he ranted and raved. He said that Letitia James is a ranting and raving like a lunatic.
Yeah. Lunatic indeed. Yeah. I mean, speaking of ranting and raving lunatics, right? We've got this guy who won't shut up about his case. I mean, the funny thing with that New York trial is, from his legal team's perspective, I actually think that was a laid out by his legal team. In other words, they're like, you know, this guy's got indicted four times. Pretty much a civil trial in New York is basically the last of our problems. We're just going to take the fifth a bunch of times in that case, because even though that can be used against us in the civil case, we've got bigger fish to fry. But Trump just figured out, like, oh, crap, we're going to lose this civil trial. Like, I think it's like he just got the memo. He just started paying attention. But it's like too little, too late. He's basically already lost at this point. The judge already found there was fraud. So he's just wasting everyone's time at this point.
So when he loses, ultimately, and as you've said, the judge has already ruled on this, what does he lose? I mean, we already know he's probably not as rich as he says he is. He's inflated his properties, which am I the only one who finds it curious and troublesome that his defense was that I couldn't possibly overinflate the value of my homes or my properties because I can always get the money from the Saudis? Am I the only one who's kind of freaked out by that?
Well, I mean, he didn't have a great defense here, okay? And the problem for him is he's got two different valuations that he's telling two different government bodies, right, or two different people. He's telling the lenders and so forth one thing. He's telling the government another thing. So the valuations can't always be right because he's telling different people different things. Right. I think for Donald Trump, like I said, his goose was cooked here very early on because him and his team, and by the way, his family too, Eric Trump, I think, took the fifth 500 something times. If you do that in a civil case, the jury can infer that your testimony would have been harmful, would have been negative. So if you say, did you commit fraud, and you take the fifth, the jury is entitled to presume you did commit fraud. So what is he going to, what do they do with that? I mean, how do you defend that case? I mean, you could be the best lawyer on earth. You could be She-Hulk super lawyer. It's not going to make any difference. It's going to make no difference at all. You know, who you've got defending you in that case, there's no way to win. And so this is just like a slow loss for Trump. Like, he's just showing up to lose, essentially, at this point.
And I would argue play the victim card. I mean, that's ultimately his, I think his plan in this is to play that victim card so that the base keeps, because look, I can't tell you how many people I've talked to who have bought it, that, you know, oh, look, they're piling on 91 counts. Don't you think that's excessive? And I go, well, when you're doing a lot of criming, that comes with a lot of counts. Yeah. When you break a lot of laws, they tend to pile up.
A crime spree. Yeah, I will say that, you know, the irony is, Rick, if one of my clients, I represent a lot of companies and people across the country. If one of my clients was in the situation he's in New York, not the criminal case, I mean, the civil case, it would be like a bet the company case for a lot of my clients. Oh, my God, they're going to dissolve our corporations. They're going to prevent us from doing business in the state of New York. All of the stuff, right, that they're going to be doing, avoiding receivers to oversee my properties. Like, that would be very serious deal if one of my clients, like a big company, had that happen to them. For this guy, it's like the last of his problems. It's like the minor problem that you just are like, well, we're going to have to take the loss on that one because we're indicted and all the criminal indictments all across the country, right? What a situation this guy's in.
No, and a lot of, like I said, you know, it's his own making. At the end of the day, this is what you did. And, you know, it's that little Beretta thing. You know, don't do the crime if you can't do the time.
Yeah. Well, this guy has done so much stuff that we can't even keep track of it. I mean, I think a lot of people forgot that this civil trial was going on in New York. They're like, oh, yeah, that happened. It's like when he was alleged to engage in sexual assault by a prominent woman author, and she wins. And everyone's like, oh, like that happened too? Like, he's sexually assaulting people as well? It's like, yeah, I guess that's just sort of, you know, that's just for this guy, it's like another Thursday, right? So yeah, unbelievable.
And the weird thing is that you go to the MAGA hat folks and you tell them this, you know, the court of law found this guy basically guilty. And look, it's going to keep coming. And there's no sense of, there's no sense of the courts are fair, that there's no sense that he actually did anything, that there's always an excuse. And that's the thing that blows my mind.
Yeah, well, I have some of that in my own family. And I guess what I would just say is there's a lot of people out there who are looking for something to believe in.
Yeah.
And, you know, for many of us, it's a higher power, you know, something greater than ourselves. And for other people, that's Donald Trump. And I think that's more of a lower power, so to speak. But the bottom line is people are blindly believing things. And I do feel bad because I do think people are being misled by him. They're being cheated. A lot of people are being cheated out of their hard-earned money. You know, people who are struggling to make ends meet are being told that they need to donate to the Donald Trump Legal Defense Fund in order to make sure he has free speech or whatever. I mean, it's just sad at a time in our country where there's a lot of people, Rick, who can't afford a lawyer.
No, that's the thing. This is a guy who's a billionaire, begging or claims to be a billionaire multiple times over. And yet he's begging, you know, average every day, you know, working people to cough up, you know, bread, milk and egg money so that he can defend himself from stuff he shouldn't have done in the first place. Just my thoughts. Last question. Do we expect any of the criminal stuff to go against him? Where are our thoughts in this moment? How do you see this playing out?
Well, the Mar-a-Lago case is basically that's a surefire guilty verdict unless Judge Aileen Cannon does something to muck up the works there, which I wouldn't put past her. Okay. So that's one thing. You're just purely looking at the evidence and the law. But, you know, as for this January 6th case, that's an interesting one. The judge is, I think it's fair to say, not favorably inclined towards Mr. Trump. She's not his, he's not her favorite person in the world. So I think it's sort of the opposite issue. It's a case that's more unprecedented. It's less straightforward. January 6th case, which has never been charged before of that kind because it's never happened before. But you're in front of a judge who's absolutely determined to make that happen before the election. So I'm interested to see. I think the question is, will it happen before the election? And that's the one case that might get to trial, criminal case before the election.
Well, I am certainly looking forward to seeing what happens. Renato, I appreciate you taking time for us. As always, great talking with you.
Anytime, Rick.
Our good friend Renato Mariani. Make sure you check out his It's Complicated podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcasts, you can find his. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Got the talk.
Open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1945. That was the day that Paul Robeson received the Spingarn Medal from the NAACP. The award was given annually to the African-American with the highest achievement. Robeson certainly fit that criteria. He was born in Princeton, New Jersey. He attended Rutgers University, where he was an athletic standout and valedictorian. He earned his law degree from Columbia. He was a successful singer, as well as stage and film actor. He was also an internationally recognized star, with singing engagements all around the world. Robeson strongly supported labor and working people. He was also an outspoken critic of U.S. colonialism. His stand for social justice made him a target of Senator Joe McCarthy during the hysteria of the Cold War Red Scare. Because of his alleged communist ties, in 1950, Robeson's passport was revoked. It took him 8 years to get it reissued. During that time, he could not travel abroad to perform. The International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers invited Robeson to sing at their Canadian convention in 1952. Since he could not travel, he sang over the telephone. The union then organized a concert on the Washington State-Canadian border. Standing on a flatbed truck parked on the U.S. side of the border, Robeson gave a 45-minute performance to a crowd of 40,000 people. He started the concert by saying, quote, "I stand here today under great stress because I dare, as do you, all of you, to fight for peace and stand for a decent life for all men, women, and children. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
What does he care if the world's got troubles? What does he care if the land ain't free?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So I gotta tell you, I love the fact that Nancy Pelosi came out and said that, just suggested that Republicans take a lesson in mathematics and learn how to count. Because, yeah, look, why would you go to the floor with a vote that you know you don't have the votes for? Why would you do that? Look, you whipped the votes before you went to the floor. You knew who was against you. You knew who was for you. You knew you didn't have it. But they did it anyway. And they did it. Look, this is what Republicans understand so much better than Democrats. They understand pressure. They understand that you put these names out. Jordan lost 22 Republican votes. There are 22 targets for MAGA World to spend their time beating up on. And like I said, you had this Marionette Miller Meeks, this Republican from Iowa, who's getting death threats because she refuses to fall in line. And I go back to what I said a moment ago. When you're the bully, you got to have something to bully with. And understand, Jim Jordan's got nothing. Jim Jordan is nothing in Congress. He's the pit bull. He's the destroyer. He's always been the destroyer. He has absolutely no legislative victories whatsoever. And now what he's doing, he's offering all the concessions he can. The latest one to some New York Republicans, to double the SALT, the state and local tax, exemption that Trump went and targeted blue states by making it $10,000. They're going to double it. For the cap to be $20,000 and $40,000 for joint filers. This is his compromise to them. Here, I'll give you some tax money. No, that's not how it works. And look, he said he's going to give money. Again, it was against Ukraine, but we're going to give them some money. We're in favor of it. Now, understand, if he becomes speaker, and I don't think he's going to. I think they're dug in. I think he's done. They're going to keep trying. Going to keep trying. Going to keep threatening. But remember, this is a guy who voted to overturn the 2020 election. This is a guy who wanted to pardon Trump for his election crimes. This is a guy who wants to ban same-sex marriage, wants a national abortion ban. This is a guy who has not passed one single piece of legislation in 16 years. Not only that, he's never even had a committee vote on a piece of legislation. And you top this with, this guy is a right-wing ideologue. One of the speeches that came out was this Oklahoma Representative Tom Cole. He was going on and on about how wonderful it was that Jim Jordan wanted to gut Social Security and gut Medicare and Medicaid. Was just effusive with praise. Because, again, Republicans want to destroy that stuff. And look, the reality is everything that the reason I started today's show off with, the fact that, in Michigan, they're actually doing things that working people want. They're actually listening to the constituents and getting stuff done. Jim Jordan's not that guy. Jim Jordan, voted against the Women's Health Protection Act. Saying that should a woman have the right to control her own body? Voted against the right to contraception. Voted against the Consumer Fuel Price Gouging Prevention Act. Voted against bipartisan background checks. Voted against the Paycheck Fairness Act, saying that women should receive equal pay in America. We can go down the list. Voted against the John Lewis Act, the Respect for Marriage Act. All this stuff that pull really well. Voted against the Child Care for Working Families Act, helping ensure that families have the ability to get some child care when both parents have to work. Voted against the Violence Against Women Act. voted against Build Back Better, vote against the Invest in America Act, the CHIPS bill, the Bipartisan Safe Acts Committee. We can go down the list of all of the things he's been against. You know what he's been for? Tax cuts for the rich. That's what he's been for. And the question then comes back, why would we want this guy as speaker? Why would you want a destroyer as speaker? Someone who has no experience on legislating. Because that's kind of what the speaker is supposed to do. And the fact that he brings to the floor losing votes shows that he's not interested.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap. WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls. W228 EP Eau Claire. And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.